Making decisions is such a personal and sometimes situational, often situational thing. And you have to just make them based on the information you have at the time. We all do this in our personal and our professional lives.
This is the Indianness Podcast, stories of success from leaders and change makers of Indian origin. Why have Indians achieved success across so many different disciplines around the globe? I have no idea, but let's find out together, because every story is unique. I'm very excited to have Mamta Patel Nagraj with us today. She's the NASA Associate Chief Scientist for Exploration and Applied Research. I invited her on this show as I was fascinated by her very unconventional journey. Welcome, Mamta. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Sanjay.
Mamta, this is the Indianness Podcast. We really go into the journeys of change makers like you. And to really understand the journeys and the purpose of the journeys is we have to go right to the beginning. And this serves as really an inspiration, a teaching moment for others who want to follow in your footsteps. So why don't you take our listeners, and we have a global audience, where were you born? Tell us a little bit about your parents, siblings, etc.
Sure, yeah. Let's see. Gosh, my parents immigrated to the United States from Surat in Gujarat to California, and they were factory line workers in an electronics factory in Southern California, and they did the soldering of the wires in that equipment. They had left behind two daughters, my oldest sisters, in India, simply because at that time, as I know many of our audience members will relate to, they didn't have enough money to bring four people over. They had saved enough money in their jobs in India to bring two people over. So they left my sisters, which, gosh, Sanjay, when I heard this growing up, I thought, oh, okay, fact of life, they left my sisters. But as a mother of young children around those ages, I do not understand the courage and the decision-making that it would take to say, okay, I think if we take this opportunity to go to this country everyone's talking about, it will benefit our family, even if we have to leave two kids behind. That blows my mind as a mother now. So that part of my story has a different feeling than it used to when I was younger. But they left those sisters and they came to America. They had me during the course of the time they worked at the factory, saved enough money, took about a year and a half before they could send money back to India and bring the sisters over shortly after I was born. I was born in California, but we moved to a small town in Texas, bigger than I make it sound. It wasn't really that big. It was the only town in its area in Texas. It was called San Angelo. And that was how life started. They purchased a motel after saving enough money, borrowing from friends and family, which is common in our culture, of course. And that's the beginning of life in America. That was the beginning of their life, which was really also the beginning of my story.
Well, that's fascinating. As you said, these are journeys that a lot of people have made. But just a few questions, Mamta. How did they decide who to bring and who to leave behind? That's just, tell me, did you ask them ever?
You know, I never asked them that question, although I should. I recently just did a huge project where I interviewed them and made a book for them about their life and short stories. I presume if I had to just think about who do you leave behind, who do you not, it was kind of a clean cut between the parents and the children. My mom's parents were capable of taking care of the two young kids who at the time were about maybe 3 and 8, around ages 3 and 8. And they could come over and get a job and save enough money, as opposed to one parent and a child versus two, both parents come over and they had a safe home to put the girls. But even still, Sanjay, as a parent, I don't know that I could do that. I don't know how bad it would have to get in the country where I lived, where I thought there was no opportunity for me but to leave it and still leave my children with trusted grandparents. I don't know that I could do that. It's tough because I've never been in that situation, right? My parents came here and created a future for me where I wouldn't have to be in that situation or in that place to make that decision. My brain can't even put together a scenario where I would have to up and leave. I can't even fathom it.
What about your sisters? Do they ever think, or have you ever discussed that part with them ever? They're getting left behind and coming.
A little bit, but you know, one of them doesn't really remember much of it, except this one piece that, again, as a parent, it gets to my heart. She does remember not recognizing or not wanting to run to my parents at the airport. When they were reunited, my parents could not wait to see the girls. I mean, she wasn't so sure. There had been some lack of trust because she hadn't been around them for so long and she was only three. So for half of her life, practically, she hadn't really seen these two people. She knew they were mommy and daddy, but that wasn't who she was going to run to. So she does remember that. By the time she came over, she was about 5 years old. So just at the point where you start remembering things. The older one, I have talked to, her name is Hemben. I call her Hemben. I've talked to Hemben a little bit about it. For her, she remembers a lot of it. And I think it was a little traumatic for her to immigrate and she didn't know the language here. And she remembers going to our elementary school and struggling to really fit in and to learn English. We spoke purely Gujarati. We still do with our parents. So she remembers that transition better than the younger one, Duxaban.
Wonderful. So now, Mamta, your memories are based in Texas, right? When you moved there, tell us a little bit about how was it? It's a small town in Texas. Now, obviously, you didn't know India or Surat, how it was. So tell us, how was it the early days there?
Yeah, you know, a lot of us laugh about, as we reflect back on our childhood, my childhood was full of happy memories, Sanjay. I have to say that point blank. When I think back, I have a very fond memory of growing up in my family. As I've gotten older and I've reflected back on some of our experiences, then I start coming to this realization of the things that we had to get through to get to where we were. And I suspect we'll get to some of those realizations. This small town wasn't ready for the people that came there in the late 70s, early 80s. It is a town that was typical of Texas then. Lots of ranches, as my dad often would say, lots of cowboys, but he wasn't exaggerating. It was certainly a town that we shook up a little bit. The 5 to 7 Indian families, largely Patel families, who had come to the region. What I think about as I reflect is I remember kids would talk about how we smelled differently. And then I just, okay, whatever, you just keep moving forward. But I think back, I'm like, what was that? And I finally figured out, Sanjay, it was gutty. These were foreign smells to the people around us. I remember people would comment on, this is going to seem really odd, but it's only in reflection that I remember this, on the shape of our noses, the shape of our eyes, these features that they had never seen before. They were not exposed to them. And I don't know that it was negative, but it was just new to them. When we were little, there was this game people would play, and I've never said this before, but I'll reflect on it here with you. It was called Hot or Not, and you would talk about how beautiful somebody was and whether or not they were. And I remember overhearing the game being played, and it got to a picture of me, apparently, and the answer was yes. I don't know. Exotic? Almost like how you might describe an animal in a zoo. Again, when that happened, I just went, whatever, and move forward. I didn't care what the kids around me were really thinking. And I was generally well-liked in school. I was nice and I was smart and I didn't get in anyone's way. But there was this earnest tone where the person just didn't know how they felt about seeing this person. The features that we as Indians have were so foreign in that day. There weren't many of us around. Of course, in 2024, this is a very different story. People love curry. They eat it for lunch. They think Indians are beautiful by and large. I mean, it was very different now, but I reflect back and I just think of these comments and these stories that as an adult, I think, wow, that could have really, if I had let it, it could have really changed my course. I didn't, thankfully, largely. But yeah, those are some of the things I remember growing up in a small town in West Texas.
What about school? You went to school to talk a little bit about your school, because we're trying to basically glean some inflection points from you. What has made Mamta who she is, learning lessons for others also. So talk about a little bit about school.
So we went through the public school system. There were a few years we went through a private Catholic school. And what I remember is there being some confusion between our religious beliefs at home, which was Hinduism, and that of the Catholic religion. And eventually those came into conflict enough that we were pulled out and went through the public school system, which I think was probably a good thing at that point. But Sanjay, in the town of San Angelo, there was the rich side and there was the poor side. And we definitely were on the poorer side of the town. And as immigrant families, and I know many of the immigrants who might be listening will relate to this, as people came here without much money. And by and large, most years of our life were under the poverty line. So we went through the school system. We did quite well, all of us, some better than others. But we strived academically to do very well. We put our own pressure on us. I wouldn't say mom and dad put pressure on us, but we ourselves wanted to, we had these big dreams, right? I had wanted to be an astronaut from the moment that I was around 3 or 4 years old, and Sally Ride rocketed into space. And that sort of shaped my adventure through the school system there. But we were definitely in the rougher areas of town, and there were things we had to navigate. There were lots of kids who were in these wannabe gangs that were based off of gangs in Compton and LA. And I remember the Bloods and the Crips and trying very hard not to get caught up in all of that. There's this one funny story of a boy, and I won't use names, of course, but my sisters and my brother and I would often talk about, because there were fights and there was a lot of school violence because of where we lived. And how we just all, literally every day, we just tried not to ever be the person getting punched. We just didn't want to get involved in that. And my brother made a comment. He said, just stick to Mumta. Everyone loves her so much, they won't mess with me. And so that was like we were nice and we tried to be nice. We knew that that reputation was what was going to keep us out of the fights. But yeah, that changed when we got to high school, because all of the middle schools filtered into one school and you were more diversified. It was a bigger group of people. And so the middle school drama didn't really go into high school. High school was large and we were very involved. I took on most of my leadership roles there, from senior class president, student body officer. That was my pathway. I was a natural born driven leader, I would say, even in those early days of life.
So one of the things you said, Mamta, was that you didn't want to get into a fight. You basically wanted to fly undercover, basically.
Yes.
Do you think that's reflective of you now also?
Maybe in ways from a social perspective, definitely not in a professional perspective. I'd say I have the opposite. So we tried to fly undercover to avoid the drama. But where we stood out and we shined was academically. And I'd say that kind of bleeds. It's interesting. I've never thought of it this way. I've never reflected this way until you've mentioned it. But when I think of myself in my career, I've done sort of the opposite. I've worked hard, and it's important to be recognized for that diligence and when you make significant contributions to your field. So I definitely try not to fly too undercover at work. But on a social perspective, sure, it might be just the person I am.
That's the person you are. You had obviously a good group of siblings, so you didn't need to reach out. Were there any friends that you made in early part of school at all?
Yeah, many. And we're still in touch. My best friend growing up was Tamara, and we could not be more opposite. She is blonde hair, blue-eyed, fully Spanish-speaking, devout Catholic. And I was this brown girl, Indian immigrant, but we had some similarities. We both had 5 siblings in our homes. Our parents did not make a lot of money. We both grew up similarly. We were free school lunches. And back in the 80s, that meant you stood together in your separate line and everybody knew who the kids were on free school lunches and who wasn't. And she and I really bonded in some of those shared experiences, things that set us apart in a time where you were just trying to fit in. And so she and I fit in with each other. Yeah, she was my best friend growing up.
Wow. No. As you said, you grew up on the poor side of the track, so to speak, free lunches, etc. Was there some level of insecurity in your mind at that time growing up?
Yeah, definitely. There was some you know, mom and dad shielded us pretty well from a lot of the stresses of money. At some point, they had, you know, they would talk about it freely, and it affected my little sister to the point that she brought it up to our pediatrician, and the pediatrician told my parents to stop talking about money issues in front of the kids. So there was a point where we really knew what was happening. And then I can remember a moment where we stopped hearing all of it. And I later learned it was because the pediatrician talked to my mom and dad. So they did a really good job from then forward shielding us from it. But there was, you know, we knew money was tight. What was amazing, though, as I reflect, Sanjay, is despite money being tight, and yes, we didn't get new clothes and we had used cars, things like that, but what never lacked was a hot Indian meal. My biggest childhood memories are of fresh rotlis on the table, huge Indian meal every night together. And I don't know how mom did it, because she and dad ran the motel together. They worked side by side every single day. And then they came home and they cooked together, Sanjay. They cooked an Indian meal. My dad didn't go and sit on the sofa. He chopped everything. And I later learned when I wrote the book for my parents about their life that my mom's parents were like that. So I think the forward thinking, not getting trapped in the conservative traditional values, must go down my lineage, because apparently my grandfather worked in the kitchen with my grandmother. Even back then, they were sugarcane farmers. They would farm in the land all day. My grandmother would go out to the farm, work with him. They'd come back and they would cook together. So it's a tradition passed down.
Wow. So money was tight, but there was always hot meal, rotli, curry, dal tokli, all those other things were there. Some element of insecurity. Do you have that element of insecurity that drives in some ways?
Yeah, I think it's still there a little bit. Obviously, mom and dad, they did what they had to do. They worked hard so that we would not be in the same positions that they were. And I think they succeeded with all five of us. We have a life that is much better, financially speaking, than how we grew up. But I think it still runs in me there. Just a short little example. I remember we didn't have central cooling and we lived in West Texas, where it would get up to 115, 120 degrees. And we would have little air conditioners and we would always fight for the spot right in front of it. Or likewise in the winter, when it would actually get quite cold, it's a little desert-like, and it would get quite cold and we would fight over the one space heater that was there. But because of that, I now realize when I want heating and cooling, I will liberally turn my air conditioner down in the summer and turn it up, the heater up in the winter. And my husband will come and say, why are you making it so cold? And I tell him all the time, I grew up without this luxury and I have worked hard and mom and dad worked hard so that I could have this luxury when I was older. So let me have my air conditioner. This is like a constant discussion. But I think at the root of it, it's because of those insecurities that I had growing up.
When you look at your parents, and obviously we, different times, different things, do you think they made the right choices?
Oh, by and large, yes. Sure, there could have been some choices that maybe could have been made differently, but if there's one thing I can say that I've learned from mom and dad, it's their leadership skills, and decision-making is one of them. Gosh, making decisions is such a personal and sometimes situational, often situational thing. And you have to just make them based on the information you have at the time. We all do this in our personal and our professional lives. But yeah, I think mom and dad are really solid and informed decision makers. They won't make a decision without knowing what's going on, all of the information they need. They balance each other well. My dad is much more thoughtful. He needs to have all the information and a night to think about it. Impulsive decisions have to be made on the spot. And there's a time and place in life where you need to be able to make a decision on the spot. You can't have a night to think about it. That's my mom's job. And he talks about that a little bit, how they had to balance each other because he can't make quick decisions and she likes to make quick decisions. And so they knew which situation, who was in charge, and they could just easily, seamlessly go between the two of them and say, you have to make this decision. I can't do it.
So it's the yin and the yang. So where is Mamta in the yin and the yang?
Oh, that's a good question. I can make I'm more like my mom. I can make quick decisions in high stress situations. And I've realized, I never really thought about who I got that from, but it's definitely from mom. But it has benefited me in my professional career. So in mission control at NASA, it is a high stress, high stakes, sometimes lives are on the line sort of atmosphere. And I got through my training because I was able to make quick snap decisions that ended up being the right call in the end that could save equipment, could save millions of dollars, could save a life. Decision making. That's much harder for my husband. He's much more like my dad. He needs some time to think about it. But I can take in the information and make a snap decision. And it usually is what in retrospect we would call the right decision.
Right decision. So this is an important part for our listeners. You obviously, as you said, make decisions that impact lives in real high stress situations. You say it came from your mom. For our listeners who want to learn about these things, what do you use to make those kinds of decisions? Obviously, you watched mom in many situations, right? So now there are people who are watching you. How do you, when you think about it, is there a method to your madness or is there just you go with your gut or what is it for our listeners?
That's a really good question. There's usually a method to the madness. And I've never written it down, but if I had to think of it off the cuff, my first one is I ask questions. I won't make a decision without asking. You usually have, even in a rushed life and death situation, you usually have a moment to ask some questions or to gather some information. The first thing I do is ask questions. And whatever time frame, if I get a minute, I'm going to use up my minute. If I have 30 seconds, I'm going to use my 30 seconds to gain that information. It can be through observation. It can be through asking questions, but taking in the atmosphere around you. I always need to know my deadline. Is it in 1 minute or do I actually have an hour? And sometimes people think they need a decision right away, especially at work, but they really don't. If you poke and prod just a little bit, they probably have until the end of the day to get the decision out. So knowing my true deadline, and then that helps me figure out how much information I'll be able to gather. If I can gather a little bit, then I make the decision with what I have, if they need it in a minute. And if I have a couple hours, then it gives me more time to think about it and to go through the process of what prioritizing that information and what are the outcomes. So my last thing I'd say is I go through the outcomes. If I make this decision, here's my outcome. I make this decision, here's my outcome, and then evaluate those and come back to the actual choice. But I usually come up with 1, 2, or 3 solutions and think about the consequence. We should always think about the consequences of our decisions and then make the decision.
So 3 good points. You said ask questions and then obviously make sure that you are aware of the consequences. And you know your deadlines. What are the actual deadlines is what you're saying for our listeners. Mamta, has there been any decision of consequence that was wrong or you made a mistake?
Have there been any? Yes, there have.
Of consequence.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There must be. I'm trying to think of one, though, as an example.
More importantly, I'm trying to, for our listeners, how did you deal with that is what I'm trying to really get to that. Because we all make decisions that sometimes go wrong, which are consequential. How we deal with them, I think, is more important. And you obviously are someone who has. So how did you deal with them? Tell us.
Yeah, let me tell you the story of when I finally got my shot at becoming an astronaut.
Okay.
It was my second shot. The first one, I have to tell you, Sanjay, I rocked my interview the first time. I was 30 years old. I didn't have any children. I was sharp still in my brain, like everything was there. And I know I did a great job because they inquired about me afterwards. I knew I had done well and I didn't get selected. And there's a lot of great stories out there, a lot of great people who were selected who have phenomenal attributes that would make them good astronauts. 4 years later, I got my shot. In those 4 years, I had 2 children and I had just had a baby. She was maybe 4 or 5 months old and I was fully breastfeeding her. And I got a call and they said, we want to interview you again to be an astronaut this year. I couldn't turn down the call. So I talked to my husband. He said, definitely, you have to go. Don't worry about the baby. We will figure this out. So I pumped milk for weeks and weeks and froze it. I did everything I could to prepare for this child. And I did everything I could to not let the fact that I had babies and I was pumping milk detract from my capabilities in becoming an astronaut, right? We have to be a little bit aware of what these things mean when you try for big dreams like becoming an astronaut. But I took my pump with me. I was fully breastfeeding my daughter. So I took my pump with me. And to continue that journey, I needed to pump milk. And those who have breastfed children know that a baby is the best pump. And these mechanical pumps are not as good at getting the milk out of the system. And there's consequences to not following that process. So I get to my interview and it's going fine. It really is. But as I reflected back on why I didn't get selected, there's a few things that I did that probably impacted the ultimate decision and probably were a result of being in that foggy post-baby mentality where your brain's not as sharp, you're not connecting things as fast. If you've never had a baby, it's hard to understand, but for all of our listeners who are mothers and have actually gone through the process of this post-baby life, the hormones, all of it is happening. And I remember small little things, but decisions with consequences. I was supposed to go on a tour and they very clearly told us all of the astronaut candidates have to go on the tour and you have to wear closed-toed shoes. And by the way, I've never told these stories before, but I'm going to tell you. And for some reason, I wore flip-flops. I don't know why I wore flip-flops. I wanted to be comfortable, maybe. I was alone without children for the first time in 3 or 4 years, and I wore flip-flops. And I remember the person was looking very annoyed and very disappointed because they had clearly told us, you can't go on the tour without shoes. And I didn't have time to go get it back. They eventually found some booties to cover me. Small decision, it didn't feel like a big consequence. The next thing I remember it's a week-long interview. The next thing I remember is there's the interview when you're in the room and you think that might be the only interview if you're naive, but the whole week, every action you take, every decision you make, they're watching you the whole time and people are reporting up what each person has done. And so we went to the social and I did all the right things. I went up to every single astronaut and I shook their hands. I introduced myself. I asked intelligent questions. I did all the right things. I had been out all day. I had not pumped any milk. I didn't bring my pump with me. And it was probably 9 or 10 p.m. And usually everybody goes out after that and the interview continues. And if you don't go, you're recognized as one who didn't go. Sunday, I was leaking milk. I was literally leaking milk, spewing out of me. And I couldn't explain that. Most people there were male. So I couldn't really explain that to them. I wasn't that comfortable. And so I said goodbye to everybody and I went back to my room. And I knew in that moment, I was probably making a critical decision that wasn't going to work out for me. But I had to choose. I could either end up with mastitis, which is what results from not getting the milk out of your breasts, or I could have a better shot at becoming an astronaut. And I had to go back and I had to pump the milk and there was no meeting them. They don't tell you where they're going. They expect you to come. And I didn't go. And sure enough, the next day, one of the astronauts called me out on it, came up to me and he said, oh, you didn't come out to the social last night. I thought, okay, here's the negative consequence to a decision I made yesterday. And I ended up all the little things I did. The one person I've shared this with in private, she told me, she said, that might be one of the strongest stories of what a woman gives up for her career, examples that she has heard. And I didn't think of it in that way, but I did make the decisions for myself, my health, my child, and maybe it impacted the end. Maybe it didn't. I mean, I'll never know, but these are decisions I think I've made that had some negative consequence, probably cost me my chance of achieving my dream. But maybe not. Maybe it led me down a path that was better. I wouldn't change it. I probably wouldn't change that. I couldn't. In that moment, I think I made the best decision. I was literally leaking milk and I didn't have a change of clothes. But yeah, I think those are probably some small examples of consequential decisions?
Two things. One is obviously you wore flip-flops, and the second thing was you didn't go out for the social. As you said, it's sacrifices that women have to make from a career perspective. So for our women, and in many cases men who are listening, what is the message here? Because this is a very important, I mean, you were pursuing a dream. If everything had been equal, things would have been very different. Firstly, you said there was nothing you could have done differently, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything you could have done differently?
Gosh, I think there's, you know, I should take that back because I think there's always different ways we can approach.
Okay.
The problem is, I don't know, in the first situation with the flip-flops, just a stupid decision, but I don't know what propelled me to make it. I don't remember it being a conscious thing. It was probably the lack of that haze I described after you have a baby, you're just not thinking clearly. I mean, the rule was there. It was clearly laid out. I knew what I was supposed to do. And then I made this decision. Could I have done it differently? Yes, I think I could have. But perhaps if I had been in my normal state of mind, would I do that today? Probably not. I read everything and I follow the rules. This is who I am. I read everything, but I just didn't put that two and two together. I made a decision not informed by what I had read. And that's not my normal method of operation, my normal MO. So yeah, I could have made potentially different decisions, but I don't know in that moment if I would have. It wasn't really conscious.
Yeah. But the other part is that you've gone on to maybe bigger and better things. Is there a message here also for our listeners that yes, were you devastated that you didn't get it at that point?
It was definitely the lowest of my lows.
It was the lowest. This was for the second try or the first try?
The second try was worse.
The second was worse for you?
Yeah, because when I reflect back on it, I think I made decisions that impacted. The first time, I think I did such a great job. It was their decision to not select me. The second time, I mean, I knew by the end of the week, I had tanked the week
you
long.
Tanked.
I had just known it. But no, it was devastating also because there's not an official age out for astronauts, but I was aging out. Realistically speaking, you know, we are in our healthy prime years in our 30s and 40s and maybe our early 50s. And the chances to become an astronaut are few and far between these days. There's 4-year wait in between everyone. And I had already gone through two. That's an 8-year process before I could get my third chance at it. And that's pretty much the decade of my 30s, maybe perhaps the prime in my health and career where I'm at the best age to become an astronaut. So yeah, I was definitely devastated. I had moments that I would say would be mental health lows. I threw things. I screamed a lot. I had young children in the house, but I didn't really have the control over my emotions that I would normally have. And I'd say, if I'm reflecting back accurately, probably a little depression in there, which is not something, you know, in our culture that people are very comfortable talking about, but I think we should. And I'll tell you how I overcame it for our listeners, because I know that's what you're thinking. I set myself a deadline, Sanjay. I told myself when I finally came to and realized how absurd my actions of the past several days had been, I gave myself a deadline. I gave myself some grace. And I said, you can have your emotional response for another week, 2 weeks even. And I did. And it was low. And there are days I moped and didn't do much. And I had a partner who supported me, who hugged me when I needed to be hugged. So I'd say having a partner, a friend, somebody who you can lean on a little bit is important. But I think giving myself the grace to be mad, to be sad, to be devastated, and then deadlining it, giving it a deadline and saying, at this point, you've got to pick yourself up, was really important for me. Part of that probably tells you I wasn't in a deep depression, because when we're in a deep depression, we don't have that wherewithal, right? We have to be understanding of those who are in a deep depression can't logically think to that point. But you know, let's say you're not, and you are upset, you are devastated, but you haven't reached a true low. And perhaps if I had gotten that low, I wouldn't have been able to come out of it. But I was in a mid low, let's call it. But that was it for me. I told myself, you can have up until this day, and then you've got to turn yourself around. But that's how I got out of it. I knew it was probably my last chance, though I'm going to give it one more go this next a selection round. But that was probably my last real good chance at it. And I had been given the opportunity, right? Got my interview. I had been given the opportunity. And yeah, some decisions later, it wasn't in the stars. But you also said something else. Do I think I came out better for it? I do. I didn't achieve my dream, but I've also learned to give myself the opportunity and the liberty to dream other dreams. I don't know what they are yet, but I'm finally letting myself come up with another dream. For so long, I defined astronaut as myself. I wear my NASA gear so proudly. This is who I am, who I've always been. But just in the last year, I'd say I have finally thought, well, what else do I want to do? Who else do I want to be? Yeah.
So you made some great points. So I want to touch on two of them, this recent one. You talked about how mental health is maybe a little bit of a taboo in our culture, or maybe was. Did you seek external help when you were completely down, if you don't mind my asking?
That's a good question. I didn't. And I think it's maybe because I hadn't gone low enough. I like to think that I would have, because I am certainly a person who is open to, and that's why I am able to talk about my personal mental health low. But even with my children, I have no problem seeking out professional help. That taboo is done in my household. And my husband is the same, even though we know culturally it was for so long, not just in Indian culture, but American culture too, looked down upon as something that we don't talk about. We whisper about it. I know for a fact that I would seek out professional help for my children. At that time, I didn't for myself. Part of that might also be because I've grown in the last decade after having children. I think children force you to grow in a way that you wouldn't before children. As I've watched them traverse the pandemic, really. The pandemic was hard for the kids, especially my oldest kid. But yeah, I didn't seek out professional help myself then. Thankfully, I didn't need it also. But I like to think, and I know in my heart I would have. And I would even in the future should we need it.
That's a great message because we all have our ups and downs and highs and lows. And there's just like you take a personal trainer for your physical fitness or something else, I think there are some great experts out there. But you made another great point, Mamta, if I can touch, that you have figured out a way to dream other dreams. You wear that NASA t-shirt, etc. There are a lot of people, as I said, who maybe are not as fulfilled, whether it's in personal or professional life, etc. Because you get fixated, you grow up thinking this is how my life is going to be, or this is whatever my professional or personal life, it doesn't fit in that box. But You've been able to say, okay, I have another box or another venue, etc. How are you able to do that? Tell our listeners that, because everybody can't do that. Is there a technique or a method that Mamta has?
I like to think in my head a lot and make up stories. And I don't know if this is a good way. I don't even know if it's the best way for our listeners, but perhaps others can share in that. You know, when I'm by myself, maybe I'm commuting to work and it's just me and there isn't a lot of noise around me and I can just think. Sometimes I'll turn off my podcasts. Usually I'm listening to a podcast on my commute. Sometimes I'll turn it off and I'll just tell myself a story. And sometimes I actually say it out loud. So other people are looking in the car and I'm just talking to myself. But I'll just make up stories of things that I don't know that I would love to do, like traveling around the world again, moving to another country and setting up life there. And some of these are things I wouldn't do in real life. So I get to really be imaginative and do my story character can do whatever she wants, right? There's no real limitations on her. And then out of those, occasionally I'll go, maybe I can't do it that way, but I could do a version of that in real life. So one example about traveling of the world and setting up in a life in a different country, maybe I thought of this. So I'm a biomedical engineer by background, and I would love to be able to create a low cost 3D printed, I don't know, something like a knee replacement that could be brought to the masses of impoverished groups, like in the mountains of in the foothills of India, or perhaps the villages where my parents came from, where it's truly low cost but can improve their quality of life. These are like little things that I dream about. But maybe in real life, I could do that. That's something I could do. I would love for my next dream, whatever it is, to be helping people more directly. I think that's what I've settled on. How I'm going to do that, I haven't quite decided yet. But I have all these skill sets that I don't use day to day, things that I have studied at a PhD level, and I don't use them. And I thought, what keeps me? Nothing keeps me from being able to use them still. We often get stuck in this career day to day, what we do, and we think we're too old to do something, but we're not. We're not too old to have a career change. I don't think there's ever a point where we're too old to change our careers. You might have to do it a little differently, start at the bottom and work your way up, or maybe start in the middle. But I do have these visions of even being an entrepreneur like my parents with my fancy degrees and everything. I feel like, I don't know, maybe having a 9-to-5 job isn't what I want in my next career move. So yeah, I tell myself these stories and I get really imaginative. And then every now and then I'll pull back and come up with a realistic version that I can actually implement in life.
So telling yourself stories, visualization is a technique that you're using, as a lot of people talk about that, and pursuing some and pursuing and not pursuing others. And maybe, and you're talking those aloud, and there's nothing wrong with that, which is incredible. And I think that's fantastic for our listeners. Mamta, just going back in time, we talk about inflection points that frame you, where our listeners, you've given us some incredible insights into what you have. Are there mom and dad were working very hard? You saw their work ethic. You probably have now absorbed that. You absorbed mom's decision-making ability, keeping 3 key things in mind, deadlines, etc. You grew up in a little bit of a tough place, some insecurities, but also flying under the radar. Are there other inflection points that have framed you? Can you talk a little bit about that? Your parents obviously have had a huge impact. And then did you travel to India after your parents moved here?
We did, not as children, simply okay. Because it was just challenging with the motel and they're, I think, flying.
Did you help in the motel at all? This is just I always wanted to know. You did, all of you?
All of us. We, from the time we were little, I remember probably being about 5 years old and dad would have us go out to the public laundry or the laundry room where we washed all of the motel's sheets. And he'd say, put out your hands. This is how we trained us early on. And he would lay down the sheets and the towels and he would say, go to room 38 and put them on the bed. And then We just grew from there to cleaning toilets, tapping. When I got older, I would tap the sewer line when my dad was aging and he didn't have the strength to tap the sewer line, which was gross, but I did it as a teenager. Got on the roof, learned how to put shingles down. My brother did a lot of this stuff with us, but it was all of us, all 5 of us doing it. But yeah, you talked about inflection points that on reflection. One, I think, is with the motel. And I didn't know that this was important until I got older. And I started thinking back about those important points in life. But I think it was really my dad. My dad has taught me so much in moments in life. But one, I think, is he set a bar for how I should be treated in my personal life and my professional life. And it goes against the grain, I think, of our culture a little bit where, you know, the woman is submissive to the man on some level. And it's become a little bit different as time has gone by and years have gone. But certainly in the more conservative parts in the small villages, that still is the way it is. But there are a couple points. So in the motel, I remember I and my brother were the 2 most interested in the hands-on activities. Not surprising that I became an engineer and I work at NASA, but that we were the 2 that were most interested in. And so we would follow my dad. And my dad once, he wrote me a letter for our school project. And in the letter, he told me that from the moment I was 3 years old, I would go and I would observe what he and mom were doing. And then I would, without being asked, go and find the tool that he needed and I would bring it back. So I was with mom and dad all the time, watching, taking everything in. But my favorite thing is the dynamic between the two of them. So we already know mom did not stay in the house and cook and clean all day. She was out in the motel working side by side. But I love how they handled problems. So I remember distinctly a broken refrigerator, and this is the 60s refrigerator. And we were now in the 80s or 90s. So it was very old. And mom and dad just kept fixing them and keeping them going. And I remember my dad took off a board, and he's the tactile kinesthetic one. He does things with his hands. My mom is all brain. And she would look at the mess of wires. And I'm not joking here. She wouldn't touch a thing. He would open it and she would look. And then she turned to him and she'd say, "I bet if you cross that red wire with that green wire, this refrigerator works." And my dad would look at her, didn't say a word. He didn't question it, nothing. He would cross the wires that she said, and bam, Sanjay, that refrigerator worked. And I saw this over and over. There was this respect between the two of them. He did not question her solution. He knew he could not look at wires and make them make sense, but she could. She had a strategy in her head of being able to turn that into something that normal people cannot. And she did not bother with the skills that she didn't have. She wasn't somebody who got screwdrivers out and saws out. That's not her thing. That was his thing. But there was a mutual respect between the two of them. And I took that in daily. And I really think that is why I became such a strong woman with a strong career, because I saw this. And in my career, I expect to be respected when I am contributing my strengths to a project. And I think it all stems from that. It stems from being in the motel, watching the way dad treated mom and mom treated dad. And there was just a very healthy, positive environment around me.
He would cook and he would listen to where she said, plug the wires, no matter what happens. But those are great life lessons. Were there other inflection points? So that's framed you from a career and personal perspective, watching the dynamic between them. Were there other things that you, so your strength, your saying, hey, I need to be treated a certain way comes from there. Yeah. Are there other inflection points when you look at your past?
Yeah, you're right. So that was how I expected to be treated myself. But I remember this one I've carried with me my whole life. And it's about others. And you know, we're in this era, thankfully, where I think there is this large movement to be more inclusive and to be more aware of people's differences and how those differences can be strengths. When I was growing up, that wasn't really the way that American culture approached people who had differences in special needs and things like that. But one situation happened at the motel. And I remember it turned into a racist situation, but there was this gentleman who was in a wheelchair who needed to rent a room. And we came out because our office was not accessible at that time, so he couldn't come in, but he was okay with that. We came out, we took his registration, we gave him the room key to number 38, if I remember correctly. And he went and we told him how to get there, and he got in his van and he drove and he parked and he got out in his wheelchair, and there was no ramp to get to number 38. There was no ramp to get to any of those rooms in that line. And I remember he came back and he was livid, livid. And in that anger, he definitely spouted things that I heard multiple times in life. You know, go back where you came from. You don't belong here. Things that many of us in this audience have heard growing up. And I remember I was 15 years old, 16 years old, perhaps. I was a teenager going through my own hormonal changes, and I reacted and I got mad because now he was insulting my parents, right? And he didn't aim those at me because I had the luxury of a perfect American accent that my parents didn't have. The insults were hurled at my parents. So eventually, even though we had a no refund policy, my dad told my mom, refund his money. We refunded him. He left. And we were all about to go in the house, and my dad pulled me over and he said, "Mamta, in the car." Okay. When dad has that tone, you listen to him. You listen. So I got in the car and I'm mad. Remember, I'm livid right now because this man has just insulted my parents. And he told me to breathe. And he goes, "Mamta, I want you to think about what actually just happened." And he's driving. He doesn't say another word. He leaves the whole 10 minutes to get to where we're going for me to think. and I'm seething. We pull up to a hardware store. We go in, we buy a bag of concrete. And he looks at me, he goes, he was right. He had no way to get to our rooms. He was not wrong. He said those things in anger and they were mean and he shouldn't have said them, but he was right. Our motel is not accessible and he should be able to rent a room from us. And what did we do? He had me go with him. We poured concrete and we built a ramp that very day. And that has stayed with me my whole life, to be able to pull away my emotions and to look at the situation and realize when somebody has made a good point. And especially in the field of accessibility, where maybe, just maybe, what it did for my 15-year-old self was made me more conscious, made me realize I'm not always right, made me think more than me. I got upset because he insulted my family, but there was an underlying truth that I missed because I had an emotional response to it. But I'll always, I think for the rest of my life, I'll take that lesson from Dad, who said, he was right. You just have to think about it. You have to listen to his words. You have to remove your emotion, and then had me build a ramp that very day.
So a great life lesson. Let me ask you this. So we all sometimes get into arguments, et cetera, et cetera. Do you apply anything from what you have learned from your dad towards that?
Yeah, I listen.
You listen?
I listen and I think. And you know what I teach my children? Breathe. Breathe. You're not going to always, you know, one of them has those little chew toys for anxiety where he will chew on it so he doesn't bite his nails. And when he forgets it, what does he do? Bite his nails. And I've told him, I said, you won't always have your chew thing, but you can always breathe. Breathe. Nobody can take your breath from you. And I've noticed him doing it. When he gets mad, that first breath can calm you down and you will have a better response. Don't respond without breathing. So yeah, I think I've taken away things like breathing, which my dad told me in the aftermath of me seething. He told me to breathe, and I suspect that's where I got it from. But listening to others before making decision, and really listening, not just hearing the words, but taking those 10 minutes my dad made me think on the way to the store and didn't say a word to me. Think about what is being said before you communicate back. Those are really difficult things when you're emotional, though. These are not easy things to do when you're mad at somebody or you're sad or you've been hurt. But taking that time to think about it, being empathetic, putting yourself in the other person's shoes, being able to see it from their perspective, I think those are all the things I've taken away from that situation. I've applied it throughout life.
There are great messages there, Mamta, because sometimes we get an email and we respond, as you said, without breathing. I'm sure I have done it. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have done it, because a lot of communication these days happens through emails. As you said, listen carefully. I think that's a great message. We sometimes listen, but we really are not listening to the other person's issues. And then also taking a moment, I think that's a fantastic life lesson. Any other life lessons? Because my gosh, you have such incredible life lessons for our listeners, Mamta.
Any other life lessons? Let me think. There are so many little ones as I've reflected back. And a lot of it is in reflection, Sanjay. Isn't it funny how we go through life and we don't realize which moments are going to define us or give us these
life lessons? That's what this podcast is about.
Yeah. You're right. You pull them out of us.
No, we try. But while you're thinking, let me just ask you, you know, one of the questions that we ask a lot of our guests, because as they're going on this life journey, we have mentors in our life. They all come in different shapes, sizes, forms, parents. We've heard during this podcast about two of your amazing mentors. What do you tell our listeners? What is the role of mentors in professional, personal, whatever else? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things that I've gotten to do in life, and that is been the mentee. I've reaped the benefits of being the mentee, but giving back and being the mentor has been one of my greatest, most rewarding things that I've gotten to do. So for those who haven't taken the time out, I'd say my number one thing for them is it doesn't take a lot of time. So many of us, especially those in high-ranking positions, think, oh, I just don't have time for that. but you do have time because often all our mentees need is the space to ask you a question every now and then, maybe a quick text message. And sometimes it's just a hug or a pat on the back or just 5 minutes of your time every now and then. It's not a daily, weekly. You don't need to set up weekly meetings with them. And if you're somebody who has a really high-ranking job, as many people listening here would, but it sometimes it's just 5 minutes of your day every now and then. And it is so rewarding to get a phone call or a text message or an email. Sometimes I get LinkedIn messages from somebody I talked to years ago, real messages that I keep because they mean so much to me. And it'll say, 3 years ago, you did a talk at so, and I heard you speak and I came up to you afterwards and you gave me your email and you helped me through this life moment. And I just wanted to tell you thank you and tell you where I am now. And then they'll tell me where they are and they'll credit me for that. And I'll always go back and say, no, that is all you. And I'm so glad you came back to tell me about your successes. But this happens regularly. And when you get that thank you, Sanjay, it is worth the time you invest in people because somebody invested in you. I told my dad this. My dad often looks back on life and he had a hard childhood. And even in the book that we put together on their stories, you know, he'll go, nobody helped me, Mamta, because I asked him a question. I said, who helped you in life? He'll say, nobody helped me. I had to do everything on my own. And I told him, I said, Dad, think about it, because I remember one or two people that helped him in the U.S. I said, somebody helped everybody gotten help somewhere. You just have to think about it in that way. So I just feel like it's one of the most rewarding things for anyone who hasn't taken the time out to give back. The next time someone asks you to help them to be their mentor, say yes. Say yes. You will reap the benefit. It may not come immediately, but in a year or 2 years, that young person or older person, doesn't have to be young, that person will achieve something and will come back and tell you about it. And it will be an unbelievable feeling. Yeah. Just do it.
Just do it. And a lot of our guests talk about how they end up learning from the mentees too. Yeah. In many cases. And you talked about how the thank you, the gratitude, but they say we learn a lot from the mentees too. Mamta, when we did the prep, you mentioned something about 9/11 and how that kind of changed some perspective for you. Can you just touch very briefly on that for our listeners?
Oh, yeah. Yes. 9/11. Yes. I had to go back mentally to incredibly difficult time in our American history. Yeah, I was a college student. As most people who lived in the U.S. at that time, I remember exactly where I was, exactly where I heard it. It was the morning alarm was going off to get me to my first class in aerospace engineering. And it was one of those things you did a double take and you're listening to the radio, and which is how we got a lot of our news back in those days is while you were getting ready, and thought, no, that can't be real. Are they talking about a movie? There was a sentiment going on. So I remember exactly where I was. And I remember we went to class and my dad, because in class we didn't have TVs and there were no cell phones. This was an era of you couldn't get news right there on your phone. And so I remember my dad was giving a lot of us this news that was happening. And those days came and they went. But shortly right after, one of my best friends I had grown up with was also in college. His name was Nick. And he came up to me. We were hanging out in our dorm rooms. And he said, Mamta, have you talked to your parents about safety after 9/11? And I said, oh, Nick, don't worry. They're not Muslim. They'll be okay. And he looked at me and he said, Mamta, people don't know that. They don't know that. You are the person who has to advocate for your parents. And it just took me in that moment to realize I understood ignorance better in that moment. I understood what was happening on a different level in our country and around the world that led to that horrific day. And I remember calling my parents, and my parents had the same reaction. We're fine. We're safe. Everything's good. Don't worry about us, Mamta. But my dad, and that was my mom talking, but my dad silently took it in. And the next day he put up a safety window in the motel. He put up extra features that just protected them a little bit because there was this uptick in hate crimes after 9/11. And my friend Nick was right. It didn't matter if you fit the profile of those who committed those horrific acts. that the people who were committing hate crimes didn't know and they didn't care. And they made their decisions in ways that were rash. But it just, when Nick said that to me, it opened up my mind a little bit about how the world takes us in and takes me in, how they might see me. I could be the nicest, kindest person, but if you don't talk to me and you don't know me, you wouldn't know that. You're judging me on what I look like. If you're the type of person who's going to commit a hate crime, then I could easily be the victim of that. So it just opened my eyes up to be a little bit smarter, a little bit wiser about it. But yeah, it was just a way to look at the world that I see things in such a positive, rosy way. Sometimes it's good to have the friends that pull you back into a realistic world and say, no, you have to see these things in a different way sometimes. I'm so grateful. And I'm still friends with Nick. I don't know if I've ever told Nick that story either back from my perspective. I should call him and just tell him. I'm glad that he just shifted my thinking just a little bit.
That's awesome. Mamta, towards the end, we go through some lightning round of questions. And we ask generally the same questions because we're trying to build this carousel. Let's ask you some questions. Tell our listeners what's your definition of Mamta.
Ooh, my definition of Indianness is pulling some of the best parts of our culture, from food to clothing to holidays, family, and having a strong knit family, because I think of that. All of the Indian families I have been around have had really strong family ties. But just being proud of where we come from, wearing the janlo on your head when you feel like it. In recent times, I've decided that there is not a wrong place or time to show your Indianness.
Not a wrong place or time to show your Indianness. I agree with you on that. I think I know the answer to that, but I'm going to ask you the one person, one, who's been the most influential person in your journey? One.
Probably has to be my dad. He's taught me so many little nuggets of life lessons that I'll keep with me forever and ever.
I think our audience knew that answer. What do you think your dad thinks about your accomplishments? Has he ever said anything?
Yes. What he says, Sanjay, and every time I get so irritated, he will not take a second of credit for what he has given to us, what he and mom both have given to us. He says they are all our accomplishments and we worked hard for them. And I tell him every time it would not have happened without the decision making he and mom had early in life. And then the foundation they gave us and the guidance they gave us to traverse these life experiences.
That is so true. That is so true. It has a tagline called Just Do It. And if you had a tagline, what would your tagline be?
Ooh, what would my tagline be?
When you're driving and you're talking to yourself, what do you think of your tagline?
Just try it.
Just try it?
Yeah. I don't think there's ever harm in trying to do something.
Do you actually do the trying bit for everything?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yep. I do. I love it. Things like mountain climbing, I would probably die mountain climbing, but it doesn't keep me from trying. Put on a harness and go climb a mountain. I did it. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Mamta, there are so many other stories. We'll need to get you back. It was just an incredible, I learned so much. Your journey, your parents' journey, maybe one of these days, I need to get your parents on the podcast to talk about their journey and talk about their kids. But what an incredible story you've had from, you never were in Surat, but from parents who were in Surat, from a little town in Texas to working to be an astronaut, now at NASA. And what great lessons, life lessons you've given our audience. And thank you for sharing and thank you for being so open. Really appreciate that.
Well, Sanjay, I have to tell you, most of us don't think we have stories. We just go through life and we live day by day, but we don't really think we have stories until we have the opportunity to be able to have it pulled out of us because of people like you and podcasts like this. So thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mamta. It's really, really been a pleasure. So look forward to having you again. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Indianness Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future inspirational stories.